Welcome to this podcast summary of the ISB and FASB's recent joint board meeting that was held from the 13th to 17th of June. I'm Sonja Horn, the communications manager of the IFRS Foundation, and I'm joined by Stephen Cooper, board member, and Alan Teixeira, our director of technical activities. To start, Alan, maybe you can summarize what were the main topics, what happened this week in the board meeting.
Sure, thanks Sonja. We had a fairly heavy agenda. We focused on two financial instruments subjects. One was asset and liability offsetting, and the other was impairment. And as well as that, we actually had a couple of education sessions. The FASB gave us a chance to have a look at their financial instruments model, their classification and measurement, and they also gave a brief presentation on how they're dealing with investment properties in an attempt to align more closely with us. And then we also looked at some of the MOU projects, the ongoing ones, insurance contracts, revenue recognition, and leases. So it was very sort of familiar sounding agenda at this stage.
Stephen, maybe to continue with that, can you give us a brief overview of what was discussed in the revenue recognition?
Well, this was our final meeting in redeliberating the revenue recognition project. This is following the exposure draft that we issued last year. There were only two topics left to redeliberate. One was a particular issue relating to telecommunications companies, and the other was transition. In terms of telecommunications, this is not a particular telecommunications issue. It sort of relates to transactions which are common in that sector, but they do stretch across other sectors. But we have spent a lot of time talking to representatives from those companies, talking to analysts, understanding what the concerns are, and it deals with those contracts which involve hardware and services. And it's the situation, a very common situation, where you are acquiring a handset plus call services as part of a bundled transaction, and it's how that should be accounted for, whether the subsidy on the handset should be dealt with as an upfront loss, as a marketing expense, or whether it should be regarded as a deliverable part of the performance obligations under that contract. So we had a particular proposal in the exposure draft, which was to treat these transactions as two separate performance obligations, recognize part of the total transaction price related to each of those. And there was quite a bit of opposition from some of the companies to that particular proposal. However, having gone through many, many meetings on this and deliberated it at the board table at some length, we decided that we would confirm the requirements that we had in the exposure draft. The last topic was transition. We confirmed the proposal in the ED to apply the standard on a retrospective basis. However, because of some of the practical difficulties of doing that, we went through a number of transition reliefs in order to relieve some of the problems in that area. I won't go through what they are exactly, but they're listed in update. So that concluded the redeliberations. We then had to consider whether we should re-expose the standard for further consultation. We went through the requirements that we have in our due process for re-exposure, looked at that carefully, and decided that the changes that we had made to the exposure draft did not warrant re-exposure in accordance with our due process. However, we recognise the importance of revenue as an item within financial statements, the widespread application of this new standard, and the importance of getting the wording right and making sure it's operational. So we decided that we would put out a document for further comment. Now, we're going to achieve two things with that. One is that we're going to ask for further input on some aspects of our redeliberations that, whilst we didn't feel strictly required re-exposure, we feel that it would be prudent to re-expose. So we're going to re-expose some aspects of the document for comment. For the rest of the document, we're going to ask for further input in terms of the drafting and the operational issues.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's worth emphasising too that even though this is a limited re-exposure in terms of the number of issues that we're really focusing on, it doesn't mean that we're only going out with a partial document. What will go out like any other exposure draft, the whole package will go out. It'll be the whole document, mm-hmm. even those things for which we believe that we've either reaffirmed the matters that were that we had in the exposure draft, or which we don't think are controversial, or for which the board is actually not actually actively seeking additional information. So they'll see the whole of the exposure draft, including application guidance and the basis for conclusion. Mm-hmm. So everybody will have the opportunity to see the package. And the other nice thing about this particular project is that we did ask the boards, even though this it's a re-exposure, an exposure draft, nobody's indicated any dissent towards any of the aspects here. So this was an unusual 22-0 project on this.
Do we have any idea on timing when this is going to be published?
Sure. Well, the thing with an exposure draft is, again, we've got to make sure that the whole package is together tidily. So the team's working on that at the moment, and our hope is that we'll get this out in July. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just quite conscious that we came out to what, for many of the Northern Hemisphere, think of as the August break. So we need to make sure that we get that out, hopefully before that August break, and that will give people the opportunity through August, September and October. So it's likely to be November or December, I think, it's a four-month comment period, so it's likely to be towards December before we actually get comments back on that. So that's, there's a lot to do to put the full package together.
Yeah, sounds like it. There was also impairment on the agenda, and Ellen, I think you wanted to say something about how that went.
Yeah, for those who follow the webcast or the podcast, they know impairment's very important to us. It's also one aspect of the financial instruments project where the boards are working very closely together. It's, you know, unlike some of the other components, that we're together on the timing. And, of course, mm-hmm. it's all when we get out of sync or out of step with timing that we have problems. We have been looking at what we had as a supplementary document for impairment, trying to develop what we call an expected loss approach. Now, over the last few weeks, we've had a working group made up of members of both boards and senior staff from the organisations, putting a sort of a working model together. And this is what we discussed this week. And essentially, we have sort of three categories of loans that we've been looking at that are trying to pick up the general pattern of credit quality of loans. Now, I'll sort of start with the two extremes, and then there's a group in the middle. First category is when you first initiate loans. Obviously, there's some sort of expectation of what sort of credit losses you might suffer over the lifetime of those loans. But essentially, you know, those are the loans you expect on average to collect cash flows for. So they're the ones that, you know, sure, there are risks involved, but they're the business as usual loans. You take another category where you've got specific problems with particular loans. In other words, things have happened. People have stopped paying, for example, so you're not collecting cash flows. Those loans really are problem loans. They're troubled loans, and so they would be in another category. And essentially, you would transfer those out of this, you know, general pool mm-hmm. into this troubled category. And I think that the new aspect of this particular model, Steve, is the category in the middle, which is you're starting to get an inkling that things aren't too well in perhaps a particular sector. You're experiencing some economic downturns in a region or a country or a sector. And, you know, some people used to think of these things as almost like incurred but not recognised. But do you want to talk perhaps a little bit about that middle category?
I mean, this is... thanks, Alan. I mean, this is an area that we do need to do more work on. One of the problems of doing these things in public, of course, is that ideas are floated and we discuss them, we modify them, and sort of this brainstorming is done out in the open. And this is very much part of that. So, you know, this is certainly not a finalised requirement, a finalised proposal. It's something that we're considering to try and match the way in which impairment is done with the way in which credit migration takes place, as you say, as things get worse. I mean, this middle category is perhaps most closely analogized to the current IBNR type notion. And it's, as you say, when things have happened that are likely to lead to losses in the forthcoming periods, and where you can identify that with some cause, some event, as you were saying. But as I say, it's early days and we've got to do more work on this. But again, we're conscious of the need to work hard on this. The problem is that it is a very difficult subject to try and get right, to get something that can be explained in terms of the impact on the income statement, the balance sheet, something that has some conceptual basis, that it's not just random numbers that are being generated, but also has a link to what is actually happening in economic terms, so that we can explain it clearly. And as I say, more work needs to be done on this, and we'll be consulting with people as part of the development of these proposals. And if necessary, we will obviously eventually end up with an exposure draft or whatever public consultation is necessary.
Yeah, and one thing we're doing with building on this, because you talked about IBNR, we're actually looking at building on the these triggers or indicators in our existing models for incurred potentially incurred losses. But the idea would be something like, you know, perhaps you've got a significant, you know, an industry is lost. And so that you know that there's going to be a big rise in unemployment, so you're really quite worried about a particular region, and it's this middle category that you would look at. So you're still collecting cash flows from these people who've got loans, for example, but that you suspect that there's a particular problem with those. So the question is whether we transfer out of those out of the general pool into sort of an at-watch type pool.
Yeah, this notion of IBNR is quite widely used at the moment. I think one of the problems, though, with IS39 is that it's not necessarily used consistently in different regions. And if we are going to do this, then we have to find a way of trying to gain greater consistency in how loans move into these different categories.
Yeah, we're looking at also, we have an expert advisory panel on this that's dealing with practicality. Issues, and that's one of the big things about this is that we can design something that sounds very appealing generally, but if you actually can't operationalize it, it's a major problem. So we've been in contact with the expert advisory panel over the last few weeks to at least start to assess this type of model, and we're going to be doing that again over the next few weeks as well.
So the third category is not so much of a trouble because we have talked about the first two.
The third category has probably been built into exposure drafts. We used to call a bad book, for example, in our exposure draft in the supplementary document.
Yeah, I mean, these are just individually identified impaired loans, and I don't think people have too much of a difficulty with that part of it.
And then we also talked about, or the board also talked about, offsetting. Alan, maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, a very controversial project in a sense, because this is one of the major differences between balance sheet reporting between US GAAP and IFRS's. When we put an exposure draft out at that particular stage, I think my recollection is it was 14-1, I think, for the ISB, and it was a close vote for the FASB. They had five board members at that stage, and the vote was 3-2 in favour. And this was a model that was going to end up, it would have quite a significant change or effect for the US reporters, because they would have to basically do more gross reporting, so that this is a case where you've got, you know, I owe you and you owe me, do we offset? And, you know, we've been through this, you know, let's say we go through a clearinghouse or we have some sort of general agreement, for example, but we settle on different days. You know, should we be entitled to offset those in the balance sheet so it just shows as a net number, or should you show what you owe me and I show what I owe you, for example? We got mixed support for this. We had a vote to see how we should proceed, and for the ISB it was 15-0, essentially in favour of retaining the proposals in the exposure draft. For the FASB, though, their vote switched around, but again very close in this case. They had three in favour of retaining the exposure draft, but four against it. So unfortunately, it's a case where we haven't got the same solution. We have a way ahead with this. Probably the most important thing we need to do is to make sure that our general general offsetting requirements in terms of how you think about categorising offsetting. You know, we have to get the same requirements, at least in our various literature. How they're then presented, in other words, whether you one organisation nets or whether they do that through some sort of link presentation, for example. So, you know, we still haven't worked through all of these things, but, you know, just feasibly, the FASB could decide, for example, to say, no, we think net's the right answer, but we'll accept that we'll put some sort of link presentation on there so something you can see. And there are other ways to do with sort of tables or columnar approaches that allow people to then reconcile between the two reporting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a disappointing outcome, and really the only way we can resolve this, if The votes don't change, is to do it via disclosure and make sure that we actually disclose the same numbers, so that even if the balance sheets aren't strictly comparable, at least there are comparable numbers available.
So we can make some big improvements. But Steve says a bit disappointing that we couldn't quite get there.
Another big topic was on the agenda, insurance. What happened there, Stephen?
We looked at a number of different issues to do with insurance as part of our continuing re-deliberations. One issue, the first one, was whether to unlock the residual margin, so-called. The residual margin is the margin identified at the inception of a contract, the difference between the premiums and the expected present value of cash outflows. And in the exposure draft, we propose that that would simply be run off over the coverage period, whilst the cash flows would be remeasured and that remeasurement would go into the income statement. Many people have suggested that what we should do is to look at how we deal with this in revenue recognition, where essentially the margin isn't locked in at an inception, but the margin is just whatever materializes at the end of the contract, and apply a similar notion to insurance. What this effectively means is that we unlock that margin. So if there's a change in cash flow estimates, so changes in claims, forecast claims, that we would offset that change in the forecast of claims against the margin, either increase or reduce the margin as appropriate, so that the impact of the change in estimate doesn't flow through to the income statement immediately. It flows through as a result of a different release of the margin going forwards. Well, we wouldn't allow the margin to go negative, because if it would do so, then it would be an onerous contract and we would require the immediate recognition of that. The boards voted for this notion of unlocking the residual margin fairly close in the case of the IESB. It was an 8-7 vote. Did I say both boards voted for it? That's incorrect. I meant to say that the IESB voted for unlocking, a fairly close vote of 8-7. The FASB, however, didn't favour the unlocking of the residual margin. They were unanimous in wanting to retain the proposals in the exposure draft. So it's another example of us having a different outcome within the insurance project.
Yeah, it was a tricky vote in a sense, because the FASB actually don't prefer not to have a separate the margins. They just want to have a composite margin. But they did go through the motions of actually saying what their vote would be if they had went back to the ISP model.
Yeah, of course, it's sort of two different layered on each other, because they, as you say, they favour a composite margin, in which case this issue doesn't arise. Yeah. Although they still have to deal with the same question in respect of the composite margin itself. So,
In fact, they've been discussing potential to unlock their margin. So.
Yeah. Well, the other issue is related to that, is if you are going to unlock it, and as I say, the ISB agreed to do that by a small majority, the question is how do you do it, or what do you do it for? So we decided that we would do it for changes in expected cash flows, but we wouldn't unlock for changes in the risk adjustment or changes in the discount rate. So it was very much focused on the cash flow forecast in terms of that unlocking. We also talked about allocation methods for the residual margin, and that we should allocate over. We decided that we should allocate on a systematic basis, on the basis of the transfer of services. We also talked about acquisition costs. This is an area where earlier we had discussed it with the FASB and reached slightly different conclusions. We actually got slightly closer together on this one after a further round of discussions. The IESB decided to modify the costs that it would allow to be treated as acquisition costs as part of the contract cash flows, and that we would modify these to exclude indirect costs. This is advertising and similar expenses. This puts us much closer to the FASB in terms of the treatment of acquisition costs. However, there is still a fundamental difference between the two boards, and that is effectively the unit of account, the IESB favouring looking at acquisition costs for a portfolio of contracts, whereas the FASB favouring to look at it on a contract-by-contract basis. Effectively, the FASB only recognising successful acquisition costs related to successful contracts, whereas the IESB looking at all acquisition costs arising in the acquisition of a portfolio of contracts, implicitly therefore including unsuccessful acquisition costs. So those were the two main areas, and deliberations will continue next month.
Ellen, leases was also on the agenda, as you said. What happened there?
Yeah, we're getting close. I could say that the two remaining issues were very simple, lessor and lessee accounting, but I suppose that's most of the project really, isn't it? In terms of lessor accounting, lessor accounting is the one area where we still haven't quite got there. And essentially, at least last month, we discussed and took off the table the performance obligation approach. So really we were down to a choice of two things, and that we either retain pretty fundamentally the existing requirements, the way we think about it now for a lessor that we've got embedded in our literature, and in the IS 17 in the US has got a US GAAP, where you essentially have either a capital lease or an operating lease distinction, essentially, for a lessor. If we did take that approach, we'd change the language so that we've got consistency, and we'd build that into our new lease model. It's either that, or we have what we call a partial derecognition approach, where essentially, which is quite consistent with our right of use model, in saying that whenever you've got a lease, that the lessor transfers essentially part of the asset to the other party, and then they look after that. And you know, you could say that they give them almost unfettered access to an asset for 3 years, for example, and then the lessor takes back whatever's left over, the residual at the end. So that's what we've been working on, and I think there's a little bit of traction out of the FASB, because FASB would prefer to stay with existing requirements, but modify to suit with the language, etc. This time they've got closer, and they're willing to entertain a partial derecognition model. But the trouble is, we've got a couple of sticking points, and they relate to two things. One is the day one gains, is whether or not to recognise a profit, essentially, or a surplus on the day you actually initiate the lease. And the second one is a thing called portions, I guess, or parts of an asset. And it's where, you own a building and you lease a floor, for example, to somebody, or part of a floor. And there's a sort of a fundamental difficulty there that the FASB has with how we deal with those. These are tricky issues, and by the way, I think it's fair to say that leasing of real estate, and particularly buildings, has every aspect of this project. That's the one thing that comes up all the time as being quite tricky, because a lot of these properties have very, very long lives, and they really challenge the concepts here. Lessees is the other one. That's the good news is we've got that resolved. If you recall from last month, we both boards decided to stick with the principles that we had in the exposure draft, and that for a lessee, essentially, right of use model, and when you're leasing an asset, for example, you must recognise your right to use that asset, and you recognise a liability or an obligation. And what we've been looking at this month was short-term things. Is there some sort of concession or to help people at the lower end of this? In other words, these are the little short-term leases and things like that. It's a tricky thing, because one of the problems we have is you could actually say, if the amounts of related financing and so on aren't really material, why separate those out? Just put the gross amounts on, for example, or perhaps leave them off completely. The question is, to work out whether it's material or not, you have to go through all the pain and hard work of working it out to prove to your auditors and others that it's not material for you to get the concession. So I think the boards ended up with taking a one-year model, saying anything that's 12 months or less, you don't have to account for under the lease accounting. You can basically just account for it on a payments basis, or the way you've been doing it now. And it's very similar to the way people think about capitalisation rates for assets they buy, for example. You're down to a much simpler model. It is a choice, so that if you you do actually want to accrue these, and in fact, if you've got, you can imagine somebody who's got a significant number of these, it may actually be quite appropriate for them to do so. So then it's not mandatory, but it certainly is a concession that's available there.
Sounds like a really full agenda. Was there anything else going on also? And maybe we can also give a sort of overview of what is happening in terms of meetings over the next few weeks.
Well, yesterday, in fact, we released a couple of new requirements, that two new changes or amendments. IS1, which is our financial statement presentation standard, we introduced some amendments to how we present other comprehensive income. The FASB released an equivalent changes for there. it's not a big, it's actually not much of a change for us. We're tidying up how we present within the OCI section, so that we talk about, for those who follow, recycled and non-recycled components of OCI. So we're trying to get a little bit more consistency there and simplify some of the language in IS1. It's a big change for the FASB because until now, some components of OCI could be presented in the notes or the statement of shareholders' equity all over the place, and it was very difficult. So they've moved and now requiring it to either be shown in one statement or a consecutive statement, the same way we do. So the good news about this is we've got the language and the requirements aligned between us and US GAAP. So even though, you know, some of the other accounting is different, you look at an income statement, you actually be able to see very comparable lines, and then you can really focus on differences in what goes into those numbers, for example, rather than trying to spend your time hunting around. That takes effect in 1 July 2012. The other is pensions, and it's quite a big package. It's a revised IS 19, and essentially we've done a few things there. We've tidied up the recognition so that people can't use what we call the corridor approach, and that means that we will see assets net defined benefit liabilities or surpluses or assets on the balance sheet when they occur, not at some later time because they're ignored because they fit within a corridor. We've simplified some of the measurement components in there. We've taken away some of the disclosure choices, and I think it'll be a lot easier now to actually have a lot more of a transparent view of defined benefit plans. And that's 1 January 2013 that takes effect. Both of those are early adoptions allowed. Next week, we've got the IFRS Advisory Council.
We have the Advisory Council. We also have a joint meeting of our preparer and analyst advisory groups on the day after the Advisory Council, so we're quite busy with additional meetings.
Yeah, and I think the other two things to look out for in the next 3 or 4 weeks, on the 22nd is our target of June, we have annual improvements, so our exposure draft should be out. And then it'll be in July, even though we're going to be tidying up all the voting and all the procedures internally. We have another exposure draft coming out on investment companies or investment entities. So this would be a scope exception to consolidation. The reason we're waiting till July is that the FASB is also putting out the same package. They're trying to remove all of their complicated references to statutes and so on in the US, so we're putting together, we have a combined document. They won't be ready to actually publish until middle of July, so we're just going to hold it back and we'll publish on the same day. So two more EDs, and that should that wraps up at least for the 6 months to this June.
It was quite a special board meeting also for a completely other reason than technical content. It was the last board meeting of David Tweedy, Warren McGregor and Tatsumi Yamada, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think we understand it was meeting number 149 of the ISB. So, you know, if we'd worked that out in advance, we might have snuck another one in to make it 150. But David was here from the very beginning. So have Warren and Tatsumi. So between them, they've put in 30 years worth of board service to the organisation. So it was a bit of a special meeting, and it finished with the staff coming in paying a tribute to their contribution.
And we gave them quite a good send-off that evening as well, so I think everybody was extremely grateful for the service that they've given and the achievements over the last 10 years.
Absolutely.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Alan and Stephen, and that was it for this podcast summary. And the usual disclaimer before we close, the views presented here are those of the presenters and do not represent the official opinions of the ISB. For an official summary of the board decisions, please visit our website on ifrs.org and look at the recent ISB update. Thank you.